Why do you eat people?
Not people. Brains.
Brains only?
Yes.
Why?
The pain.
What about the pain?
The pain of being dead.
Hey guys, I'm Chris.
Hey everybody, I'm Robert.
And we're the Film Flamers,
bringing you our deep dive for Comedy Month. It feels like it's been a minute.
Right. I feel like it's been forever since we've recorded a deep dive, and I've been looking forward to this for a long time.
Same, since we started our podcast.
Right. Although I hadn't seen this movie in particular, yet. I don't know when you showed it to me, but I finally watched it a number of years ago, sometime after we started the podcast, right?
So you watched this movie on your own. I wasn't there for your first viewing.
Okay.
When we did our top 10 zombie movies.
Okay.
Because that was back when we were doing top 10s regularly, and we were like trying to make a point to like watch the ones that each other picked that we hadn't seen before.
Right. And that's when you watched Shaun of the Dead.
That's when I watched Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah.
And this movie is one of my comfort horror movies between this and A Nightmare on Elm Street, which we've also covered.
That's right.
This year on the Film Flamers. Well, this Film Flamers calendar year.
And in particular, Dream Warriors, right?
Right.
And there's some weird connections between the two.
Uh-huh. Good. I hope there's some fun facts, because we are finally talking about Return of the Living Dead.
Right. The movie that sounds like a sequel, but isn't.
That's right. It's a 1985 American comedy horror film written and directed by Dan O'Bannon in his directorial debut from a story by Rudy Ricci, John Russo, and Russell Striner. It stars Clu Gulager, James Caron, Tom Matthews, and Don Kalfa. The film tells the story of how a warehouse owner, accompanied by his two employees, mortician friend, and a group of teenage punks, deal with the accidental release of a horde of unkillable, brain-hungry zombies.
The film, described as a mordant punk comedy,
I had to look that up.
Mordant is known for introducing multiple popular concepts to the zombie genre. Zombies eating specifically brains as opposed to eating other forms of human flesh, and zombies being invulnerable to a gunshot to the head. Additionally, the film's soundtrack was noteworthy, as it features several Los Angeles-based death rock and punk rock bands of the era.
And my, how death rock has changed. Because I would not have used that particular musical subgenre to describe any of the songs played in this film. Okay, listeners. Send more paramedics. This is Return of the Living Dead.
In the dark of the night, something strange is going on.
You see that movie, Night of the Living Dead?
Sure.
They ship those bodies.
Well, say hello. The dead. Have risen from the grave.
Mister, there's 100 of those things out there.
How many did you say?
100.
And now the question is, how do we get them back into the ground?
Bert, Frank, we have a little problem.
Boiler, 10 right. No.
Medical science is battle.
And it's a puzzle. Because technically, you're not alive.
Why do you eat people?
Not people. Brains.
How do you kill something that's already dead?
Well, how do I know, Fred? I don't know. Let me think.
It's not a bad question, Bert. In that movie, they destroyed the brain to kill him. Is that what they did?
The brains, right!
Brains!
Brains! The brain!
I hit the brain!
Oh! Get it off! 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 Get it off!
The villain. secretary is nervous.
How was your day?
Usual crap.
The police are confused.
Send more cops.
It worked in the movie!
Well, it ain't working now.
Are you in the movie line?
It's not a bad question, Bert. It's not a bad question, Bert. It's not a bad question, Bert.
The Return of the Living Dead.
On July 3rd, 1984, at the UNITA Medical Supply Warehouse, Foreman Frank, played by Clu Gulager, is trying to impress new employee and town simpleton Freddy, played by Tom Matthews, by telling him creepy stories about the random bullshit they sell, like split dogs, fresh cadavers, and perfect teeth skeletons. Frank spins a yarn about how the movie Night of the Living Dead was based on true events, but the movie's plot had to be changed to avoid liability. To prove his story, he shows Freddy military drums that UNITA received due to a transportation fuck-up. These drums contain real-life zombies and a toxic gas called trioxin from the events in the 60s. Frank accidentally breaks the drum, releasing the gas and knocking both men unconscious. Meanwhile in San Diego, Colonel Glover, with the wrench, arrives home and berates his wife about always having to be available just in case the military zombie drums are ever found.
God save Herb Lamb Chops.
When the men awake, they find the zombie from the drum missing, and a cadaver in the walk-in cooler has been reanimated, is throwing the biggest fit inside. Unsure of how to handle this fiasco, they call their boss, Bert, played by James Cameron, to assist. The men release the animated cadaver and try to kill it by puncturing its brain, which doesn't work. Night of Living Dead did indeed lie. They dismember the corpse, but find that every part of the body can survive independently. Bert decides to call in a favor from his friend, Ernie. Bert and Ernie, goddammit. The mortician next door, and they bring the body to his embalming room. Meanwhile, Freddy's girlfriend and fucking idiot, Tina, and his friends, Spider, Chuck, Casey, Scuzz, Suicide, and Trash, played by Leanne Quigley, decide to party at the cemetery next to UNITA until Freddy is off work. Trash, completely turned on by all the death around her, decides to take off her clothes and dance on a tombstone because, you know, why not? Tina ventures off to UNITA to check on Freddy. She wanders into the basement and stumbles upon the hideous Tarman, the zombie from the military barrel. He screams, "Brains!" at her and tries to attack her, but she hides in a metal closet. At the mortuary, Bert has convinced Ernie to burn the reanimated cadaver in his crematory furnace. The smoke from the chimney rises into the air, mixes with the atmosphere, and causes an acidy rain to fall in the area. The rain sinks into the ground, reanimating the corpses buried in the cemetery, burning Trash's naked, dancing body. The group flees to the warehouse where they find the Tarman trying to open the door and get to Tina's brains. They save her, but Suicide is killed. Okay. They flee the warehouse, but are attacked by the re-emerging zombies. Trash is killed, Chuck and Casey run back to the warehouse, and Spider's cousin Tina reach the mortuary, where they find Frank and Freddy very ill from breathing the gas. Trash, now a naked zombie, rises from the cemetery mud and begins to hunt and feed. Paramedics are called to give them aid, and they determine the two men to be dead, but seemingly very much alive somehow. The group barricades the doors and windows of the mortuary, but Scuzz is killed trying to defend it. During the kerfuffle, they capture the upper torso of a rotted female zombie and tie her to an embalming table. Fearing Freddy and Frank will be brain-hungry zombies, the group locks them into the chapel along with Tina, who's a fucking idiot and won't leave her fucking boyfriend.
Wee Chapel of the Dawn.
The group decides to take advantage of the situation, since these zombies can talk, and interview the half-zombie. She tells them that the zombies can feel themselves rot, and eating the live brains of humans helps to ease that pain. Meanwhile, Tina, that fucking idiot, is attacked by her zombie boyfriend and has to be rescued by the others, who blind Freddy with acid to the face. Frank escapes the chapel in confusion and commits suicide by burning himself in the furnace. Bert and Spider escape in a police car, but the huge horde of zombies prevents them from getting far and they crash into UNITA, where they decide to call the phone number stenciled on the military barrels. Finally, Colonel Glover has found his stuff. Ernie and Tina barricade themselves in the attic with a very hungry Freddy taunting fucking idiot Tina about eating her brains, if she had any. Colonel Glover readies a military strike on the town, and on the morning of July 4th, a small area of the town is destroyed by a nuclear attack, killing all of the zombies as well as our heroes and fucking idiot Tina Cacciadorian. Glover is pleased and reports that everything went perfectly. Only 4,000 citizens were killed. But as soon as he speaks, a toxic rain falls once again and the zombies are heard screaming in their graves.
The end?
Or is it? Because there's many, many sequel.
There is many a sequel to this film.
Yes.
The dead return many times.
Mm.
I can feel myself rot.
Brains.
Brains. The Return of the Living Dead was initially set to open in Los Angeles and New York in September of 1985 before gradually expanding through October. But following positive test screenings, Orion Pictures became confident enough to give it a wide release in August.
The film earned $4.4 million opening weekend, securing the number 4 spot at the box office. Other films in the top 10 that weekend included Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Cocoon, Back to the Future, and Fright Night. What a good weekend at the movies.
Right?
It would go on to earn $14.2 million against a budget of $4 million. So, a modest success.
Yeah, I would say that it was a pretty good box office draw,
mm-hmm.
right? Return of the Living Dead holds a 91% on Rotten Tomatoes and is certified fresh. The audience score sits at 79%. The consensus reads, a punk take on the zombie genre, Return of the Living Dead injects a healthy dose of 80s silliness to the flesh-consuming.
Roger Ebert gave the film 3 out of 4 stars, writing that the film is, quote, kind of a sensation machine. Made out of the usual ingredients, and the real question is whether it's done with style. It is. Stephen Holden of the New York Times called the film a mordant punk comedy and stated that it is by no means the ultimate horror movie it aspires to be. I don't think it aspires to be that at all.
I don't think it does either. Fuck you, Stephen.
Yeah, fuck you.
Stop using those big words.
Mordant.
You're so mordant, Stephen. You're so mordantly obese. It does have some near accolades, though. At the Saturn Awards, it was nominated for Best Horror Film, but lost to Fright Night. Nominated for Best Actor, it was James Caan, but lost to Michael J. Fox from Back to the Future. It was nominated for Best Director, but lost to Ron Howard for Cocoon. And it was nominated for Best Makeup, but surprisingly, or maybe not, lost to Day of the Dead.
Yeah, I don't know that it's a makeup issue so much as an actual intestines issue with Day of the Dead.
Yep.
Interesting that it was up against Romero.
That's right. You know, and Romero was also up for Best Horror Film that year. But, you know, Fright Night is what Fright Night is.
Yeah,
of course. Super popular in the 80s.
Yeah. So, big cast here.
Huge. Right?
Yeah. So, we've got Clu Gulager, who, of course, is the big boss, right? With his James Stewart vibe. The way he talks is very old Hollywood to me.
Well, I feel like he is an old Hollywood star.
I don't know if he was a star, though. You know what I mean? He's got a big resume, but he never really, like, headlined, as far as I know.
Yeah. I'm sure my father would know better than I do. You know what I mean? Like, I always recognize the name, but...
Yeah, I mean, like...
But maybe just from
like
this.
Hume Cronin or something. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Also nominated for a Saturn Award that year.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Well, who I really recognize is James Cameron. Sorry. James Caan.
Yes.
Who played Frank Johnson, because he was in Poltergeist a few years earlier. And it's just funny that he was in that because he's talking about the Skeleton Farm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And Skeleton Farm was an idea that came out of the making of Poltergeist, because Toby Hooper said all their teeth are perfect when they come from India. So, but we know that everyone in India doesn't have perfect teeth. So it's like they must be growing these skeletons in a farm. So that's exactly where it came from, was actually Toby Hooper, who comes up later in the making of this movie, by the way.
Really?
Yeah.
I feel like I'm going to learn so many things about this. Right. And I mean, like I said earlier, it's one of my comfort horror movies. Like, I've seen this movie hundreds of times, probably.
Yeah. I've seen Poltergeist probably hundreds of times, and James Cameron, I keep saying that, James Caan is, of course, the one of the, if there was a human antagonist, I guess he would be it.
Yeah, because he's like the owner of
He's not like a foil, but I mean, he's like the boss, the real estate boss, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so he moved the bodies. He moved the headstones, but he didn't move the bodies, right? Mm-hmm. Famously. And Poltergeist. Anyway, so I recognized his face. Of course, sadly, he has passed, along with many other people from this cast, actually.
He's so good in this movie,
though. He is, though. And it's kind of a thankless role.
He's super, super funny and like just really, really endearing. Like, I just really like his character a lot, and I think he does an amazing job in this movie, both from like a horror movie standpoint and a comedy standpoint. Like, he's just hilarious, and his comic timing is really, really good.
Yeah. Next up, we've got just like a slew of people, right? We've got Don Kalfa as Ernie Kaltenbrunner, who plays the mortician, but he was also incompetent hitman from Weekend at Bernie's.
I haven't even thought about that movie in decades, probably. Right.
We have Tom Matthews as Freddie Handsome.
Tom Matthews is like horror royalty.
Right. He was in Return of the Living Dead 2 as well as a different character, I guess, because it's kind of a reboot, right?
Yeah. So James Karen is also in Return of the Living Dead 2, okay. I believe. And they're playing like a pair again in that one.
I like that.
Yeah.
He's also in Friday the 13th, 6 and 7.
That's right.
Right.
So when I was a little like growing gay boy, especially in these Friday the 13th movies, I had the biggest fucking crush on Tom Matthews. I just thought he was super dreamy when I was younger.
Yeah, and he's cute in this movie too, mm-hmm. right?
But stupid.
Along with Miguel Nunez as Spider, who I believe was homeless before, you know, as he was cast for this movie.
Really?
And I haven't really seen him in other things, so I don't know if he went on and did stage or whatnot.
But he kind of looks recognizable, you know? And like, out of all the like quote-unquote punks in this movie, I feel like he's the most capable and the most handy to have around, right? He's also kind of like smart-assy.
Yeah.
But I really like his character a lot.
Right. And John Philbin as Chuck, he was the suit guy, like the punk that was wearing a suit. Or I guess he wasn't even a punk, really. But he was in Children of the Corn as like Amos, I think, North Shore, Return of the Living Dead, Point Break, and Tombstone. I don't know who he was in Tombstone or some of those others.
No.
Apparently, he's just like a you know, passing role of maybe you have a few lines. I don't know. It's not super memorable.
No, but I mean, he's super dressed like very, very 80s, yeah. right, in mm-hmm. this movie. Not punk 80s, but like what you think of like douchey 80s, I guess.
I guess. We've got Jewel Shepherd as Casey. I don't know that she did much more. Brian Peck as Scuzz. He was the Mohawk dude, a little bit shorter. Mm-hmm. Now, he's known now. He has gotten an increase in popularity these days because, of course, he's just on the documentary Quiet on the Set because he is a convicted sex offender.
Oh, shit.
He was on All That, I guess, that Nickelodeon show. And he was he helped kids with their lines or whatever. And apparently he... You know, offended sex offended, whatever it is. And also, he was allegedly pen pals with serial killer John Wayne Gacy.
Oh, well, he just sounds fucking charming.
Yeah, he does, right?
Good God. All right, moving on.
Meanwhile, we've got Mark Venturini as Suicide. He's like the main punk driver, but he died of cancer at 35. I would have expected like of these characters to be true of their characters, like that would be the one. That was the sex offender or something, but no. Apparently he was a sweetie. Jonathan Terry as Colonel Glover. He was in Halloween 3 Season of the Witch.
That's right. But we cannot talk about the cast of Return of the Living Dead without talking about Linnea Quigley.
Right. And she played Trash, but she, of course, is horror royalty. I don't know if you can say she's a scream queen so much as a horror queen, right?
I would say she's a scream queen.
And she was in Graduation Day, Silent Night, Deadly Night, Night of the Demons, A Nightmare on Elm Street, Dream Master, actually, as one of the screaming ghosts coming out of Freddy's
chest. Are you serious?
Yes. It's a cameo. And Pumpkinhead 2.
So Linnea Quigley is, I mean, the people who are fans of horror movies, especially 80s horror movies, know who this woman is, right? Because she was seemingly in lots of slasher films. And like, she just has a lot of horror presence, you know, and she's super known throughout the horror community. Like, she has like a horror exercise video thing from the 80s.
Nice.
And I mean, like, every movie that she's in, she plays this really memorable character. Like in Night of the Demons, she's the one that's like rubbing the lipstick all over her breasts, you know? Yeah. And in Silent Night, Deadly Night, she gets like pinned up on a deer head that's on a wall. You know what I mean? She gets memorable kills. She's naked in lots of the movies that she's in.
Yeah, this one. It's said that she has spent more time in Hollywood movies naked than dressed.
So if you recall this year at the Overlook too, in the pre-show entertainment, there was a whole interview segment with Linnea Quigley talking about like her sex scenes or being naked and showing like a movie where she was killed by a shower head to the throat. You know, I mean, like she is just all over horror and continues to be.
Right. And she said she was comfortable with being naked. Right. She's comfortable with herself. What she's not comfortable with is like sexual sex scenes.
Right.
And from what I've seen, she doesn't really do sex scenes. She's just like parading around naked.
Yep. I mean, in this movie, for sure.
Yeah.
Right. So when I was younger, the things that my parents let me watch were probably, well, I saw this movie when I was about six or seven.
Wow.
Because I already loved zombies by then. And my parents didn't care if I watched violent things. But when it came to nudity, they were like, no. So I was watching this movie with my mom. I remember watching this movie for the first time. And she was like, close your eyes during that tombstone dancing scene. But then Linnea Quigley had her clothes off for the rest of the movie. And if I were to close my eyes, every time she was on screen, I would have missed a lot. So my mom was like, just watch it. Just watch it. So those were the first titties I probably got to see.
Wow.
Yeah. Hey, Linnea.
Quigley down under. All right. Should we talk about the concept of this? Like how it came to be?
Yes, because I feel like you're going to be laying some stuff on me that I don't know. And I'm super excited to know these things.
Well, I think you know more than you think you know.
Okay.
Right? You know about Dan O'Bannon.
I do know about Dan O'Bannon. I mean, because obviously you and I both love the movie Alien very, very much.
Yeah.
So that's a name that I know well.
Right. So Return of the Living Dead has its roots in the novel, actually, by John Russo, who, of course, was a co-writer of Night of the Living Dead with George Romero.
Yes.
Jorge himself, right? And so it was actually titled Return of the Living Dead. So, like, I guess George never really wanted to do that, you know, but it was by that co-writer, which I thought was interesting. So it's kind of an unofficial sequel, really.
Okay.
And I didn't know that going in. And it kind of hangs a lantern on that in the script, right? It says Night of the Living Dead lied, and it was actually about this and, and everything else. And it's just kind of very tongue-in-cheek about it. But it obviously it was meant to be a follow-up, a direct follow-up of Night of the Living Dead way back in 1968. So when Russo and Romero parted ways after Night of the Living Dead, Russo retained the rights to any titles featuring the Living Dead, while Romero was free to create his own series of sequels, beginning, of course, with 1978's Dawn of the Dead, which of course remains a classic and one of the most important zombie movies ever made.
So he just dropped the living part of it.
He did. He started Of the Dead, right? Meanwhile, John Russo and producer Tom Fox planned to bring Return of the Living Dead to the screen in 3D and be directed by none other than Tobe Hooper, who had signed on at that point.
Wow.
Yeah. So this is where some of that other things got kind of written into that script, right? Because of Tobe Hooper's experience on Poltergeist. However, Tobe Hooper dropped out when Hemdale Film Corporation actually experienced difficulty raising any funds for the movie. And of course, that delayed the start of the production. And he ended up making Life Force from 1985 instead. I've never seen that. Have you?
Yeah, I've seen Life Force. I mean, it's good, but it's nothing like this movie. I feel like you should have waited.
Meanwhile, I was all interconnected because Life Force co-screenwriter Dan O'Bannon, who, of course, wrote little movies like Dark Star, Alien, and Total Recall, was then brought in to give the early script a polish and was offered the director's seat itself, becoming his first big film. He accepted on the condition that he could rewrite the film radically so as to differentiate it from Romero's films even more.
I'm glad that all this stuff like led to Dan O'Bannon, right?
Yeah.
Because I feel like without that, this movie would be completely different and way too serious, maybe. If Tobe Hooper were making this movie, it would be very, very
But you
serious.
Would have thought the opposite because Alien is a very sober movie.
It is.
Right?
But, I mean, if you look at things like Total Recall, not a very sober movie, you know?
No.
It's like popcorn fun.
He can definitely change his tone in a way that most writers can't.
And this movie has a very, very set tone to it. And I'm sure that we'll talk about that, you know, at some point in this deep dive.
And how?
I mean, Dan O'Bannon really created something very, very special here. And I feel like all this is so fortuitous that it led to him doing it. And I'm glad it was his first, like, big movie.
So. Yeah, and he said, you know, he spent 37 years of his life not even being alive. Now he's fulfilled. That's what he said after he made his directorial debut with this.
Oh, that's good. I like Dan O'Bannon.
Yeah. So when it came to filming and releasing, although the movie is set in Louisville, Kentucky, it was actually filmed in Burbank, Sylmar, in downtown Los Angeles. And as we briefly touched on, Return of the Living Dead was initially set to open in Los Angeles and New York in September 1985 before gradually expanding through October. But following positive test screenings, Orion Pictures became confident enough to give it an immediate wide release in August.
So I remember when this movie was released, right? And I remember the things that sort of like started my fascination with it because it happened at a very, very young age, as I've already said. So my mother took me to see Follow That Bird, if you're familiar with that Sesame Street film.
Oh, no.
And while we were at the theater, they had a poster for that, like a coming soon poster, and it was for Return of the Living Dead. I had already seen Dawn of the Dead and was completely fascinated by zombies. Yeah. And I stared at that poster so long and begged my mother to take me see that movie. And she was like, no, you're not going to
that. Poster is very like artist, you know, like mm-hmm. like illustrative, right? It's much more like Creepshow-ish in a way.
Yeah, it was very Creepshow-ish. Like the zombies are cartoony a little bit, very comic style.
Yeah.
But they're all dressed like punks, the zombies are. And I was just fascinated with it. And so she was just like, well, maybe you can rent it whenever it comes out on video. And I did. And it just started this complete love affair with this movie for like the entirety of my life.
Right. And I think it's like some of the zombies in here, as well as the artwork, are also inspired by kind of a departure from the more documentary style of Jorge Romero's
mm-hmm.
version, but more going back to kind of the Creepshow
right.
Era of the... You know, kind of like not the Penny Dreadfuls, but like the little the horror comics. Back
yeah, like those EC comics.
And the EC comics, 56, like the Bog People and stuff. Mm-hmm. Like Tarman is actually based off of like the Bog People and stuff like that, right? And so we get a lot of that here, and we get that in the artwork, and we get that in some of the style of this. Like a lot of Creepshow, I feel like has kind of similar tones to this one.
I agree. I mean, because Creepshow was kind of tongue in cheek itself, and I feel like a really good word to talk about when you talk about the vibe of this movie is like camp, you know?
A little bit.
Yeah. But and I feel like Creepshow has some of that as yeah. well. The thing is, it's like some of the zombies in this movie are super Muppety. You know what I mean? And like, I don't know. It really helps to send that camp value over the top, right? Like some things are super, super serious when it comes to zombies in this movie. It's just not
right. at all. Well, this movie definitely has that vibe to it, right? Like we were talking about, like we keep bringing that up, the tone and the vibe.
Mm-hmm.
Like this almost seems like with the punks, it almost seems like a 1950s or EC Comics idea of what teenagers or punks are like artificially modernized to the 80s. And sure enough, of course, Dan O'Bannon grew up in the 50s. Like most adults making movies, you know, for kids in the 80s, right?
That's right.
And so it's like this weird, like hyper modernized version that didn't really exist, I don't think. Like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Bebop Rocksteady of punks in the 80s.
No, I mean, I'm sure the movement existed. You know, people dressed sort of like this.
Of course. You know, you know, like especially like New York, you know,
yeah.
and, you know, there was a whole multiple subcultures, right? Rocking like ballroom culture and things like that. And there's punk culture and things like that on East and West Coast, you know, but I think that was like the 50s idea of that, you know, what they were. And it was kind of an interesting way to make this movie even more tongue in cheek.
Yeah. I mean, and I'm not sure what Dan O'Bannon was like when he was a kid, like growing up in the 50s and early 60s, you know, but if you look at that time period, a lot of the adults then were looking at teenagers of the time. Right. Yeah. And, you know, rock and roll was becoming a thing, and it seemed like people were really scared of what teenagers were becoming, you know,
as they always are.
Right.
Satanic panic, all that stuff. Was
exactly. Yeah. And so that's what I was getting at is by the 80s. I mean, like we have things like the Satanic panic. So when you have kids sort of like dressing the way that some of these kids do in this movie, right, of course, it's going to scare like the older folks. And what this movie does is like really make these two groups, like the older generation and the new generation, sort of like work together to solve this problem.
Right.
Right. I really like it. I like that juxtaposition of characters in this.
And something that supports all of that is, of course, the fantastic music by Matt Clifford, who doesn't really have any other composer credits. Like, this is his only feature film credit. But, of course, he's known for actually being a longtime musical collaborator with Mick Jagger and a touring keyboard player with the Rolling Stones.
Well, that's quite a claim to fame.
So. It is. And it's like, how did they get this guy randomly? It's so weird. And it's like, maybe he just wanted to dip his toes into it, you know. And, of course, what we got is an iconic, you know, 80s horror score that's over the top, tongue in cheek, and it works really, really well, especially for kind of our interludes, musical interludes, at the beginning, after the opening kicks off the movie, as well as when the rain starts to come down.
I think that's like really the best musical moment in this movie. Yeah.
100%. After that opening, when, you know, he's like, the tank's fine, and the army built this, and the Corps of Engineers built this, and he slaps the side, and of course it explodes, and they fall unconscious, freeze frame, you get that blast of horror synthesizer music from this guy, and you're just like, yes, and I can imagine people in the theater just clapping at that moment. You're like, here we go. Like, we just got to the top of the hill on the roller coaster, and we're just like gliding down now.
It really sets up everything that happens, you know, after that moment. And because he had that, like all the way through this movie, like it's really fun. And it's very horror-esque. It's very 80s horror, you know,
right,
without being too overly synth, but the synth is like there.
Right. And sometimes dating something with music is harmful to movies, like they didn't age well or something like that. Like, I'm watching like some of these 90s or early 2000s movies, and they overuse their pop music from the time, and it's kind of painful.
That's right.
You know, or cringy, but it works for this one because of its tone, right? And so the soundtrack features a lot of classic punk rock from the 80s, horror and punk death rock, psychobilly songs by groups like The Cramps, 45 Grave, TSOL, The Damned, The Flesh Eaters. Right. The soundtrack is jam packed and has been re-released multiple times, including a special release edition, I believe, within the last 10 years on vinyl.
That's right. That vinyl was very popular when it came out. The song that I remember most from this, like as far as like, you know, popular songs go, is like Trash's theme. Right. Yeah. Because they play it a lot with her. It's like, tonight we'll make love till we die. And I'm like, what?
I want to make an early thousands version of this where it's just like Evanescence.
Right. Oh my God. If Evanescence were still around, I would demand they
cover
that.
Wake me up.
Wake me up. Make love till we die. My gosh. But
yeah.
I mean, like, that's the song that she's like seen through, and when she's dancing on the tombstone, you know what I mean? Like, that song is present. And, it gets played like toward the end of the credits too.
Like, I also like how she looks as a zombie. Like, she reminds me of like that big bad at the end of Ghostbusters, right?
Yeah, she does. She looks like that, right? Zool,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
She also has like a David Bowie-esque quality to her, right? And I mean, I just can't say enough good things about that character in this movie. She's outlandishly crazy. You know what I mean? And I'm sure that we'll talk about like some of our favorite moments and stuff like that, like throughout. But I really like that whole like dancing on the gravestone thing. I mean, I'm a gay man. You know what I mean? I can appreciate a woman's beauty or whatnot. But like, just leading up to it, she's like, "Have you thought about the most horrible way to die?" And her voice is
a lot of
foreshadowing.
In this movie.
I'm like, okay, so obviously that's how she's gonna die.
Yeah,
but I mean, it's just great.
Yeah. And that's part of the tone, right? And like, this movie is walking the line of serious zombie horror along with, you know, that tongue-in-cheek wry parody, like a dark comedy and even some light social commentary, especially by the end with, you know, the military and everything.
I wouldn't even say it's light. I think it's just light just the way it's presented, you know.
Yeah, but there's a light air. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's it's not mordant.
It's not mordant at that point.
So there's nothing really quite like it, you know, except for maybe some of like the segments of Creepshow or something. But even then, they are what they are as far as just like little segments. And this is a whole movie. And I almost wonder it's like a happy accident because they really wanted to steer clear of the documentary feel, cinema verite from Night of the Living Dead, Romero. And they wanted to go into a more tongue-in-cheek place, but still be kind of achieve the things that he was able to achieve with social commentary and things like that. And I think this really does that eloquently.
I agree. I feel like this movie definitely has something to say, like underneath its surface, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like when you really get it, you get it. with this movie.
I mean, come on. We have a cul-de-sac that just happens to have everything we need for the story. Like, you know, we have the mortuary, and we have like the random, you know, which you'd think would be enough for the bodies, right? But no, we have things like, you know, half dogs and like, you know, split dogs, I guess, and like everything else. And, you know, and then we've got the cemetery across the street, and we've got this, like, it's great.
It's so fucking contained. Like,
yes.
It just really, really is, you know?
It's perfect because it's all just right there, and it's just all written that way, and they don't care.
But I feel like even like within the setting, you have all these things like right next to each other in this little cul-de-sac, right?
It's almost like a stage play.
It is. But all these areas are so well thought out in the production of this movie. Like, they all look very separate. They all look very distinct. And you can easily tell like where you're at no matter what while watching this movie.
Right. Yeah, it's not even a cul-de-sac, right? It's just like, it feels like a dead end, though.
Like, it's like a little industrial area.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like the end is the mortuary. On the left, like, is the UNITA. And on the right is the cemetery.
Right.
And, like, all the action's happening in the interplay between those. And it's just, like, it's really easy to follow. Like, you know what's happening at the same time.
It'd be super easy
in all three places at once. Like, it's great.
It'd be super easy for these zombies to like get away from that part of town and like deeper into Louisville or whatever, you know what I mean? But they don't seem to.
People that don't get that movie, like this movie, I don't understand really, because it's like, you get the tone like at the beginning, you kind of feel like maybe it's a little cheesy, you know, or maybe they're not doing it on purpose,
right?
But as soon as he slaps that barrel and the gas goes everywhere and the frame freezes and you get all that music, you know exactly the movie it's trying to be.
That's right.
Right? Popcorn horror. This is going to be a fun time, and it wants to be a fun time. It's not trying to really go out of its way to scare you or do anything. It just is what it is. And so it's like, I don't understand who people who don't get it even at that point, right? Super early on, this movie tells you exactly what it is.
I can see how some people would want it to be either more campy or less. You know what I mean?
Maybe. There's definitely really great beats in this with some kind of slog in between, in my opinion. But that's subjective. Remember, like, I don't know who we're talking about really, because remember, the Rotten Tomatoes score here is 90-something%.
Based on lots and lots of critic reviews. You know?
This is a classic movie. It's a classic horror movie.
It really, really
is. It's certainly like a top three zombie movie, maybe, or top five at least.
Yeah. And I mean, and it's definitely one of my favorite zombie movies. I mean, I have a thing for Romero, and I always will. You know, I mean, that's kind of like what started my horror love.
But... Well, it's like your favorite movie is Night of the Living Dead.
Yes.
And then your favorite comfort movie is Return of the Living Dead, which is kind of a spiritual successor in a way. Yep. You know, so that kind of makes poetic sense for you.
So, I mean, if I've ever had like just the worst fucking day, you know what I mean? And I want to watch something that makes me feel good. You know what I mean? Like, this is what I would watch, because it makes me laugh, and I still get zombies, like really Muppety zombies, but they're fucking cute Muppety zombies.
They are. I mean, like, let's talk about this though. Like, their zombies in this movie are unlike any other zombies that I've seen.
Yeah.
28 Days Later has our famous, like, everyone, you know, that grew up in the 90s and 2000s thinks that 28 Days Later is the first running zombie. No.
Nope.
I don't even know that this is the first running zombie, but it has running zombies in this.
Yeah.
These zombies run, they talk, they problem solve, they say send more paramedics, send more cops.
Yep.
They can have conversations, they have empathy.
They do.
They can use tools, right? And so these are unlike anything else, and they are dead, and they are reanimated. So they are legit zombies. You know, it's just they are more capable almost than any other zombie I've ever seen.
I mean, you have to think about, like, when the tar man is attacking fucking idiot Tina, you know, and the people walk downstairs and see him for the first time, like her friends, before they save her. He's got a fucking chain wrapped around that metal door and is trying to pull it off. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. These zombies can open up doors to get you when you're in a car. Like, there's no hiding, really.
They can make traps. They can lie.
You know, they do. They ambush you.
Yeah.
You know? It's
really
fun. They hide
and then they come out, like really fast. So they literally run or sprinting.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so, like, that could have been really, especially with some of these effects. Like them just sitting on the ground eating the brains out of the guy, like that looked fairly real.
Yeah.
Like that looked really good. And these things are like, if the tone had been slightly off, this would have been a terrifying movie, probably. You know.
Well, and when I was younger, I was still scared by it. You know. So I mean, but like the thing is, I feel like it shies away from the gore, or maybe not shies away. I think they intentionally didn't have it be that gory, just because, like, again, that's not the movie they were making. They were making something a little bit more fun. You don't have to have like the blood and guts of like Day of the Dead, you know? Like, yeah, we know they're eating brains and not the entire human body. And that could have been done for a myriad of reasons. Maybe it didn't have the money to have that kind of gore effects, but like it works.
Well, they did really, really well, obviously, famously really, really well, right? The zombies look fine, right? Tarman looks great. He was a hero zombie, you could say.
He's fucking
as
iconic.
Far as like, you know, his effect. And then you got the brains lady, which is completely different. Very desiccated, you know, remains half of a lady animatronic, you know, and is having a conversation with these people. It's puppeted by three people, including one of the actors that are sitting right there. I think Thomas is one of them. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And so it's like, that's an iconic scene. And this is also kind of the first time that zombies wanted brains specifically, right? And so it's iconic. I don't know that most people know that. I think they just thought, oh, brains and zombies has always been a thing, like chocolate and peanut butter. No, it's this movie.
Do you, I mean, this is a testament to the staying power of this film and how many people saw it when it came out, or how it just reached people. Because I knew people who had never seen this movie before. And then you just mentioned zombies to them and they're like, brains.
Exactly.
And I'm like, no, no other zombie movie is specifically brains except for like Return of the Living Dead 1 and 2.
Yeah.
You know? And I was just like, so this is a testament to how like pervasive this movie was into the horror community and horror at large.
Yeah.
Right? Like it just influenced a lot of people. And I mean, that brains lady scene, it's one of my favorite scenes in any zombie movie, just because it's the first time that we get an idea of what it's like to be a zombie.
Yeah, it's kind of horrifying. And you just start to empathize with them. And you're like, they're only doing what they desperately want to do.
Right. Because, I mean, she looks like she's in pain. She's sitting there talking about how she can feel herself rot. And, you know, we just had this whole
course of this movie. We're going through this whole thing with those two characters where they've been subjected to the gas, but they're like slowly dying. And then finally they're going through rigor mortis.
Yep.
But they're alive for it. And so it's like all of their muscles are cramping and they have horrible headaches and everything else. And we're having to watch them go through this horrible thing. But if it weren't for the tone, then it would be almost unbearable to watch. Right.
That's right. Because they still find ways to joke.
So, yeah, because you still see, you know, like the only way for them to kind of like feel at peace or normal is to literally consume brains, which is, of course, fucking stupid.
Yeah.
But it's fun. It's fun. It's popcorn horror at its finest.
It is. I mean, it's just like we just had a whole episode deep diving into It Follows, talking about like being scared of dying and things like that, right? Or like life itself,
right?
Right. And now we have zombies talking about what it's like to be dead, you know, and that's just not something that most movies talk about. And she literally says like, we can feel ourselves rotting.
Well, it's also something this franchise does again and again, because I remember some things certainly in Return of the Living Dead 3.
Yep.
Where there's kind of, you know, you start to approach, you know, maybe like an Interview with a Vampire melancholy with it. You know, where it's like, this is what it is to be dead, you know,
and
grappling with XYZ.
I will say that there are some really, really funny moments in this movie that make me laugh out loud, like every time I see it. Like number one being when they realize that the split dog has come back to life and they're trying to beat it to death with a crutch. You know what I mean? We're like, kill it. You know?
They said if they had a bigger budget, it would have been a Great Dane, but they only had enough stuff to do like
a little Scotty.
Yeah.
I mean, every fucking time I watch this movie, I just crack up at that shit. And then one of my favorite lines, and it's not even that funny, I don't know why I laugh at it so much, is when they're trying to kill that zombie out of the walk-in cooler. And it doesn't work, right? They can't puncture the brain. And Freddy goes, you mean the movie lied? I don't know why. I just fucking love that line so much.
I love the details. I love seeing the butterflies
that
are pinned to the thing in the frame thing. You can see all of the...
All of it moving?
All of the wings moving. Even though they're pinned to the thing and they've been dead for, you know, presumably years and years and years.
So this affects animals too.
Everything.
You know, it's just like, I don't know. This movie just has... Just everything in it.
Butterflies, zombies, MTV's Dan Cortez.
Would you call Return of the Living Dead a horror movie?
I would, obviously.
Obviously, it's about zombies. There's a half-torsoed zombie on a table, and they're interviewing it like Barbara Walters.
I mean, it's a quintessential and a classic horror movie.
Yeah, I would say that it's required viewing, actually. Were you scared while watching Return of the Living Dead?
No. No, and I never saw this as a kid, right? So it's not a nostalgia boner for me. And I saw it was never young enough to be scared in this movie. The tone prevents me. There was one moment where I think they're barricading the doors, and always something that jumps out. So I was Dolby shocked once in this movie.
When I was younger, I was definitely scared of this movie. You know, I watched it very, very, very young. And there were certain moments, specifically the brains lady, like, scared me when I was younger. And then when Trash becomes a zombie, like, that scared me too, because that's one of the few, like, real zombie moments, is when she's, like, in silhouette walking up to that homeless person and, like, bites into his brain, you know?
Yeah. And you could see the bite marks, scrape marks, some teeth at one point on one person's scalp. They didn't make it through, but you could see the wound. And it's pretty horrific. Yeah. They did a good job.
So some scary moments for people who maybe have not, like, seen a lot of horror movies.
Sure.
You know? But the final question, and most importantly, who's the hottest guy in Return of the Living Dead?
Tom Matthews.
Tom Matthews for sure.
Obviously.
He's so fucking dreamy. So dreamy.
He's also the only, like, non-complete douche. He's an idiot.
Yeah. Also, he's not a douchebag until he becomes a zombie. And even when he's doing that, even when he's taunting his girlfriend, it's still really funny. And he's kind of endearing. And he's like, Tina, you smell so good. You know, he's talking about his brains, and he's like trying to beat through that attic door. And
his line delivery is so great.
You made me hurt my hand, Tina. It just fell off.
But I don't care, because I can smell you. I can smell your brains.
Fucking love it. Do you have some fun facts for me?
I do.
What are they?
So the stories featured 2,4,5 trioxin chemical, developed by Darrow Chemical Company for the military, was a play on the real-life Dow Chemical Company and its involvement in the 1960s with the manufacture of Agent Orange, specifically known by the name 2,4,5-T-dioxin, and used in the U.S. military's Operation Ranch Hand and on Canada's CFB Gagetown Canadian Forces Base in rural New Brunswick during the Vietnam War as a powerful defoliant.
Oh, is that why he said it was to spray on marijuana plants?
Yes.
At some point, yeah.
Although defoliant, I would say, is more of an herbicide, right? Yeah. Versus, I think, what he was saying is to make them grow, right? So that was kind of like a tongue-in-cheek thing to twist into something funny, right?
I love it.
So Return of the Living Dead, obviously, you know, made it about weed.
Again, talking about, like, teenagers in certain, like, points in time.
Right, and also kind of to show how the telephone game happens with stories, right? Because they're not even sure how those barrels got there, really. No. You know. Anyway, next up, the filmmakers had to get approval for Lysol to have Frank spray away the stench of death with their product. Quote, they liked the idea that Lysol would kill any conceivable odor. Today would be Febreze.
I forgot they wouldn't spray that Lysol.
And they double-fisted it. So on the back of Freddy's jacket in the theatrical version, the words, fuck you, are displayed. After realizing that the shot could not be used in case it was ever shown on TV, a second jacket was made that literally says television version.
What?
And can be seen in the TV version of the movie. And that doesn't tell you what kind of movie this is. Come on.
I fucking love this, because I didn't even know that it said fuck you on the back of that jacket until last night.
I would pay for that in some sort of
auctions.
Yeah.
Yep. Television version. That's fucking gold. I've never seen this on television, but now I kind of want to.
So some of the zombie extras were paid bonus to eat real calf brains in the film. Dan O'Bannon didn't want the actor to do anything he wasn't willing to do and ate some raw calf brains first in front of them to show them that he wouldn't ask them to do anything he wasn't willing to do on himself.
I mean, that's how I manage people. I eat calf brains. Well, I mean, it's perfectly safe.
According to Jewel Shepherd, Dan O'Bannon met her in the early 80s when he was a member of a very ultra-chic and private club where she worked as a stripper. They became good friends because they had a lot in common, and, of course, he bought her drugs. When he got the direction gig for the film, he wanted her to play Trash. But she was fed up with being naked on stage and in her small film roles at the time, so she suggested she audition for the party girl Casey, since she liked to party. He agreed.
I just want to party. She says that so many times in this, too. When are we going to party? Yeah. The dialogue between the teenagers in this movie is just fucking good. I love it when all of them speak, when they speak to each other, when Suicide is talking about the way he looks as a punk, you know, and he was just like, do you think this is a fucking costume? He was just like, no, this is my life. I have things to say.
I'm a dedicated punk.
I mean, like, he's just so deep. Meanwhile, Trash is just like, yeah, and like rubbing all over him at the same time. I love these kids so much.
Yeah, he pushes her. Don't you have any respect for the dead?
Yeah, have some respect for the dead. Pushes her aside. Meanwhile, just moments earlier, he was running around her while she was dancing, holding a flare. Yeah. I mean, like, come on. These are people that I would have hung out with when I was in high school.
So for my personal favorite fun fact from this movie, Lana Quigley's character was originally going to be called Legs, but was later changed to Trash after she was cast.
Aww. She spends almost the entirety of this movie in nothing but leg warmers. I mean, yeah. Trash. Just like I thought.
Trash.
Oh my god. Okay, those were really, really fun. And I did learn things about this movie during this deep dive, so thank you very much for that. Well, I think that just about wraps up our conversation on Return of the Living Dead. As always, we want to know what you think about this movie. Do you think it's a classic? Do you get all the subtle humor in this? We want to know. Find us on social media at The Film Flamers on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all the things.
You can email us at tiredqueens@filmflamers.com or call our hotline at 972-666-7733. Ooh, dance on my grave.
I would be surrounded by old men, and they would rip my clothes off and bite at me.
Isn't that a typical Monday and Friday night for you?
I mean, yes, typically. We have a little bit more Return of the Living Dead content coming for you this comedy month. Head over to patreon.com/thefilmflamers to catch our bonus episode on Return of the Living Dead 2. Essentially the same plot in a different setting.
I'm looking forward to it. I've never seen it.
It's funny, and it's different from this one, but kind of the same. You know what I mean? I can't wait for you to watch it, actually.
In my own time, I'm definitely going to be revisiting Return of the Living Dead 3.
I would also like to revisit that movie because I watched that a lot when I was younger, too. Punk in different ways.
Mm. Yeah.
We also need some reviews, guys. We are inching ever closer to 100 ratings and reviews over on Apple Podcasts or iTunes. So head over there, leave us a 5-star review. Tell us what you like us. We're going to read that on the next Shooting the Flames.
Well, Rodmer.
Yes, Chris.
I think it's time for me to wrap on an old military barrel and see what happens. Like a genie's lamp.
Hold still while I gas you.
Oh my god, it was like a genie's lamp.
It was. The Darman came out. Live brains. And then maybe we can have some
brains.
Sweet dreams.
I can feel myself rotting.
The pain. Fucking love this movie.